The Spectator magazine combines incisive political analysis with books and arts reviews of unrivaled authority. Subscribe today for just £12 and receive a 12-week subscription in print and online, plus a £20 Amazon gift voucher, absolutely free. Go to spectator.co.uk/voucher.
Welcome to Coffee House Shots, the Spectator's politics podcast. I'm Fraser Nelson, and in this episode, we're going to be talking not about the political news, but about those who bring it to you, the political journalists, or as they're known, the lobby. Frances Elliott has been in the lobby for almost 25 years, the last 11 of them spent as political editor of The Times. He's recently stepped down and has written an article in this week's magazine looking back over his experience. James Kirkup is a former political editor of The Telegraph, of Bloomberg, and, like me, of The Scotsman. They both join me now. Frances, in your piece, you look at a fairly radical transformation in what it has been like to be a political journalist in the time you were there. What do you think the biggest changes have been?
Lots of different ways. I think the emergence of the journalists as a sort of sole trader in charge of their own brand with their own Twitter feed has essentially kind of transformed the relationship between papers, how they think of themselves. And when I joined the lobby in kind of 98, one of Alistair Campbell's frequent rants was the blurring, as he saw it, between editorial comment and news. Well, that's just continued and being almost completely rubbed out. So that, you know, it is rare now to find journalists who don't feel the need to opine, I guess.
Interesting. This is quite striking. I remember, like, I was in the lobby for almost 10 years. But at the time, there was a sort of understanding, really, that you had commentators and you had political writers. And there was quite a delineation between the two. The political journalists were not particularly ideological, not from my memory. But then again, they weren't supposed to be. Their job was to get stories. And what you're saying, Frances, is even if they don't have a column, they do have a Twitter feed. And that encourages them to sort of take positions, because Twitter tends to give the most likes and retweets to those who take an angle on a certain story.
I think it's an ever-present danger. I remember my teenage son, who's old before his year, saying, "Dad, do you realise that you've got a device that could end your career in your pocket at any one moment?" And, you know, it really is that. And I think we all struggle, and, you know, continue to struggle in a sense with how to manage those boundaries. I wouldn't overdo it. I think there are that way of being a kind of warrior monk. I don't know, there are lots of different ways of being a kind of lobby hack, but it's very rare now, I think, to find a kind of pure story getter who is absolutely equal opportunities, who is down the line, who you would struggle to think what their politics were, but who isn't kind of therefore just kind of nihilistically cynical.
James Kirkup, you were in the lobby for Bloomberg, then The Scotsman, then The Telegraph. How did you notice it changing during your time there?
Yeah, I joined the lobby. I'm a relative stripling compared to Frances. I joined the lobby in 2001, gave up my lobby pass in 2017. I changed a lot. I mean, obviously, there was the personnel shift. I mean, I think the lobby got a lot younger, or maybe I got older, I don't know. I mean, when I arrived, there was a different sort of hierarchical tribe of journalists who were led by the literal greybeards of the community who'd been there for a very long time and had often begun their careers out in the regions. I think that was one of the big sort of career shifts that took place. I mean, Frances is absolutely right about the technological shift, and so that shift towards political journalists feeling free to comment on things, which would have been pretty unthinkable when I arrived. And certainly a lot of journalists of that generation, I mean, some of them, you know, without naming names, I mean, some of them literally wouldn't vote in elections because they thought it wasn't right to be, you know, reporting on something and taking a position in politics.
But that's what Adam Bolton and Sky told the Parliamentary Committee once. He said that I don't vote because the moment you do, you pick a side, even subconsciously, and it's fundamentally wrong for a political reporter to pick a side.
Yeah. So, I mean, yeah, that's definitely a big shift going on, which is just a generation of journalists now think it's okay to have views about things on Twitter. That's where we are, and, you know, I think that's probably reflective of society as a whole.
Right, but James, I put it to you, I mean, it was interesting why political reporters feel the need to go on Twitter. Could it be not simply that they basically want to promote themselves selfishly, but they think they are judged by their papers on how many Twitter followers they've got.
Oh, absolutely, yeah. Yeah, this shouldn't turn into a conversation entirely about Twitter, but I mean, Twitter did immense harm, I think, and also brought a lot of good to political journalism. I mean, by the time I was a particularly grumpy political editor, I spent a lot of time shouting at the reporters on my lobby team to get off Twitter, to leave their desks and get out and get around the Palace of Westminster and drink cups of coffee and eat lunches and get drunk with politicians and find out what people were not saying on Twitter. But yeah, because you know, there is an awful lot more, even to the Westminster Village, than what goes on Twitter. But because it's immediate and it's quick, and because actually you're often, bluntly, you are, as a reporter, you are working under news editors and editors who are also looking at Twitter. And when they see your rival has dropped something on Twitter that breathlessly announcing that something is about to happen in half an hour, the instinctive thing for them to do is say, well, hang on, why am I learning about this from the Twitter account of a rival newspaper's lobby team? Why don't I hear this from you? And so you are pushed to spend your entire time on Twitter trying to be the first to tweet something. And that becomes the currency. That becomes the way by which your professional stock rises and falls. Which, yeah, again, there are good things about it. It's harder to hide on Twitter. It's more, yeah, there's more immediate scrutiny of what people do. But equally, it creates a lot of unknown unknowns in that, you know, the stuff that's not on Twitter doesn't get recognised and talked about at all anymore.
Francis, how about actually meeting and talking to politicians? Did that happen a lot more when you started your political journalism career than it did at the end? I mean, is there an extent to which because the whole idea of being in the lobby is that you actually are in the Houses of Parliament. You've got access, you can pretty much walk anywhere you want in the House of Commons. If you have a lobby pass, you can go right outside the chamber itself. And there's a sort of division, well, there was in my day anyway, between political journalists who had a lobby pass and could go into that chamber and those who didn't and were merely afforded access to the cafes and whatnot. But the point was that your job was to go around to meet people, to sniff the air, to gather sort of one-to-one intelligence. And I'm wondering to what extent that changed, and towards the end, there is more emphasis on sitting in a desk and writing up copy from electronic devices that you could frankly have done pretty much anywhere.
WhatsApp is the new lobby.
Well, first of all, I mean, huge sympathies to those who are there now trying to do the job in the pandemic, because that whole strand has gone, and it is to be fervently hoped that when we get to whatever new normal that we get to, that we get back to. I mean, the big shift was actually, you're right, when I arrived, the thing you would do is, I should give away trade secrets, but there were a couple of places to stand. There was the members' lobby itself, immediately after PMQs, because they had all come towards you. You kind of felt like a seal waiting for the salmon to come through the lobby, and you would pounce on whoever you needed to.
And the deal was that you couldn't approach them, wasn't it? That was the idea. You had to stand there waiting.
You can't run up to them. The no-no is that having engaged in a conversation, you weren't, as a fellow journalist, then to come and kind of, you know, bandit somebody else's buttonhole.
Can I ask both of you, did any of you ever see a copy of the lobby rules? This mythical document that was supposed to exist that told us how to conduct ourselves?
Yes. I had a copy. I was given a copy, actually, before I even... Anyway.
16 years as a lobby journalist, I never saw a copy of our rule book.
So that's interesting. What do they say, Francis? What are the rules?
It's an appallingly kind of... I think this is a version in the 50s. The lobby did overhaul its rules, and there is a current document, which I'm sure a select committee could possibly kind of adduce, you know.
There's a whole philosophy seminar to be done about the definition of talking on lobby terms, a conversation between a politician and a journalist that is held under lobby terms, that all, which bits of that conversation can then be reported and under what terms.
Well, perhaps, Francis, you can give us your... This is what a lot of people do wonder. What would you regard as the various categories of conversation? Like, what would you regard off the record, not for briefing, lobby terms? What do they mean to you?
So I suppose the hierarchy is absolutely not for use, under no circumstances, which is like the worst. Like, I hate it when people say that. It's like, well, don't tell me then. I mean, that's like saying, here's a sweetie, you can't have it. I mean, just no.
It just means you wait a week and give it to somebody else, doesn't it?
Yes.
Too many trade secrets here, James. Francis, anyway, go on then.
So not for use. What's the next one? I would say...
Background terms.
Background terms, which is, I interpret that as attributed to a source with care.
Or even you can report that something is happening, but you can't necessarily say how you know it.
Yes.
So you can just, you know, there's this mythical idea that you can go away and just report that the government will today announce that fish has been banned with no sourcing. You can't explain where you got it from. You can just say you know it, baffling the reader even further.
One of my favourites was the Telegraph quoted French sources, which I thought was Mr. Hollandaise, Mr. Mayonnaise, who knows? Anyway, there you are.
And then off the record, what does that mean to you, Francis?
Off the record is close to background, probably synonymous with it. I mean, you know, a particularly naive kind of new intake could say off the record and they meant not for use. Many have fallen into that trap, but there you are. I'm not.
But would you anonymously quote somebody who'd given you something off the record?
Yeah.
And I guess your moral point would be that the minister could not be identified from the way that you'd written it. That's if a journalist would seek to protect their source by using it in a way that your source would not get in trouble for having or regret having spoken to you.
Exactly. I mean, that would be the guiding principle on which, on the whole, I would conduct myself, which was I don't want, you know, I want my readers to profit from this material, and I think that this is a relationship that they could further profit from if I keep it alive, and therefore, you know, there are rules, and they're not actually completely codifiable.
But the thing is, what you're saying, Francis, is over the years, these conversations with their rules, the written or unwritten lobby code or otherwise, have given way to more electronic things, where a young journalist now starting their career is likely to spend far more time over a computer than one would have done 20 years ago.
When I came back to the lobby, because I had 3 years off for good behaviour in Delhi, and when I came back, I remember, I think it was Ed Balls or somebody like that, essentially kind of saying, you don't realise, you know, everything's changed, you know, it's become rabid, you know, I can't trust anyone. And I think there was a sort of change in the terms of trade. I've heard it said that the kind of career structure, you know, that journalists want to kind of make a name for themselves very quickly and then get on, and that there are some who, you know, who have no interest in fostering long-term relationships and kind of do a sort of slash-and-burn thing. But, I mean, it was ever thus, and I just think that's...
Right, but there's one interesting aspect to that, James. I'd like your thoughts on it. Certainly, I think all of us joined the lobby roughly at the same time. Francis, you were 98, James, you were 2001, as was I. And I was struck there that how many more people there who'd been there for like 10 years or more. And it seemed to me that where political journalism differed from other forms of journalism was that you had people whose power and potency as reporters was based in the fact that they had, for several years, built up contacts and relationships with people. So perhaps you might have befriended somebody when they were a new MP, and you might have kept that relationship going. They would rise up the ranks, as would you. And the only way of getting top flight contacts as a political journalist was having had worked on them for literally for years.
Yeah.
And that wasn't something which you could just drop in. You couldn't parachute somebody in as political editor and expect them to be able to do the job properly because they wouldn't have the contacts. So it seemed to me that political journalism was fundamentally different and that it would take you several years to be working in Parliament if you're going to be any good, if you're going to have people pick up the phone. And even, by the way, not for use, can be useful because it can tell you if you're barking up the wrong tree or not.
Yes, you're absolutely right. As I said earlier on, that sort of the sense of there being a tribe with elders was very, very strong at the time. And I mean, you should point out that, I mean, obviously the three of us are now, sadly, middle-aged white men having this conversation. And when we all arrived in the lobby, that was the only sort of journalist on the lobby. It was an incredibly unrepresentative place, changing a little bit, but not a lot. But yeah, I mean, there were definitely people who were essentially... Their journalistic careers, they belonged to the lobby and to Westminster, and they would go... There was a very, you know, very small career track. There were people who just went from job to job, from newspaper to newspaper, outlet to outlet, but never left Westminster. And, you know, and to an extent, I did that. I mean, I did three jobs at Westminster, so over the course of about 15 years, I moved jobs twice, and my desk moved about 10 yards down the same corridor. And I spent my entire time with the same, working alongside the same people who happened to, they sometimes shifted newspapers. So there was a definite group of people who belonged to Westminster.
Right, and that's because the best way of getting a promotion was you brought with you your contacts.
Yeah.
That was a large part of the capital.
And amazingly, I can't believe we've got so far the conversation without talking about lunch. I mean, when we arrived, the only way you could really build up that relationship with politicians, bluntly, was to go out to lunch with them and to drink with them. And that was the norm.
Well, it was for you because you had these massive Bloomberg budgets. Let's bring in Francis here. Francis, what were your recollections of lunches? I mean, there is, I don't know if it still happened, but when did the three-bottle lunch start to die a death? Because when I came along, I was introduced to this three-bottle lunch, right? You had three bottles, you had two people, and the idea was to stay a little bit less drunk than the person you were lunching, yes. So you could remember what they said.
Oh, my goodness. This is a whole new podcast, Fraser. You well know. I mean, you know, this is...
Great lunches we have known.
Right, but what I'm wondering is, have these now died out? I mean, at what point do people stop?
On the whole, dinners are a much better bet for that these days. No, nobody really kind of does two bottles over lunch anymore. I don't know, maybe some Sunday hacks. Possibly only on a Tuesday.
I can think of a couple.
I probably lasted my last two-bottle lunch somewhere in the early 2000s. Mm. But dinners kept on going. And dinners, I was, you know, it's horses for courses. Increasingly, I could only face dining with people I liked, which was one of the reasons I kind of knew that it was time to hang up my boots. But, yeah, there are people for whom it's worth oiling the wheels with a large amount of alcohol, and it's worth the kind of...
Right, but you're saying this happens over dinner and it's quite rare now, whereas 10, 15 years ago, it was a lot more common.
You were doing at least a bottle over lunch and at least three or four times a week. There was a lot of alcohol. I mean, I kind of allude to it in the piece, you know, there was a functioning bar. I mean, you know, basically people conducted their entire journalistic career from the bar. They never left it. They dictated copy from the bar while drinking.
Right. And James, is it such a bad thing that this is sort of, you know, I can imagine somebody listening to this thinking, oh, this sounds like the city before the Big Bang. Is this really the proper way that you should be doing business, being drunk the whole time? I mean, right now, when you think of what a journalist has to do, the number of words you've got to churn out, the way that we do now podcasts and other things, it's simply not possible.
That's the important connection, I suppose, because the nature of the work changed. I mean, you could, bluntly, you could go to lunch at 1 o'clock and drink a bit too much if you knew you didn't have to file a copy until 6 o'clock. Yeah, when it came about that you had to be on essentially ready to file at any point because the website needed feeding or you had to tweet, that becomes less viable.
Is that because the number of stories you have to file a day, has that gone up?
Yeah, essentially the expectation of output of journalists rose a lot. So you couldn't just go off radar. I mean, it used to be, I mean, the normal working day when we all started, you'd roll in about 9:30, 10 o'clock, have a slightly hungover breakfast on the terrace, or go over the papers, maybe ring the desk and tell them that you're about some things that you think are going on. Lobby briefing at 11 o'clock, mull over what that might mean for the day, for the stories, not sure, go out to lunch, back in for lunch about 3 o'clock, and at that point you actually engage with the news desk and start talking about the stories you're going to file at 6 o'clock. That all disappeared because, you know, there was a story running all the time and, you know, the news was on Twitter, news was online. I mean, I'm not saying, you know, I am not defending the drinking, you know, which Francis is absolutely right, was in retrospect quite remarkable. If you think about, you know, wine at lunch, pop to the bar, you know, you're literally the press gallery's own bar, and then, you know, and then maybe you're down to the Red Lion or somewhere else after you've filed, or strangers after you've filed to sort of, you know, to catch up with contacts. There was an awful lot of, you know, routine low-level drunkenness. And our generation were much less drunk than our, you know, than our forebears, some of whom, as we know, literally passed away from an excess of drink. So I think the fact that sort of today's lean, mean, tweeting 20-something lobby correspondents are frankly better, smarter, energetic, and more, you know, probably more useful to their readers than we were in many ways.
Right. So Francis, is that one of the reasons you left then? It wasn't as much fun anymore.
Yes. Actually, I mean, the booze, are, you know, not so much the booze, but yeah, I mean, the pandemic, kind of Brexit and then the pandemic, really did drain quite a lot of fun from...
I can see why the pandemic did it, but I'm interested to know why you think Brexit was deleterious.
Why was it deleterious? Well, it was just incredibly hard work, and I made a promise to myself in the midst of that I wouldn't ever kind of subjugate my family, everything else, to, you know, to this obsessional job that just eats you alive. These were kind of 70, 80-hour weeks, you know, in and out. I mean, and a place that was quite rancorous and a story that was so divisive and to sort of try to kind of keep sane and safe, actually, in that kind of, in that maelstrom was very wearing. And I kind of thought, and I just remember having a kind of thought to myself, actually, you know, this isn't worth the candle. This, to my own kind of well-being.
No, but that's interesting what you say, Francis. You're saying that you were political editor of The Times, right? One of the most important jobs, some might say the most important political journalism. I guess what you're saying is it's a job which absorbs everything about you. And you're saying that you could only do that for so many years. It's like being prime minister or something like that. I mean, it'll ruin you if you do it for longer.
Tiny, tiny violin, right? Who cares about... Absolutely, I can promise you.
I care, Francis.
Nobody will care. But it is just the case that, you know, for Steve Swinford, for Ben Reilly Smith, for, you know, for Heather Stewart on The Guardian, Pippa Creer on The Mirror. You know, their day starts at 7, if they're lucky, 7, maybe even earlier, you know, with the Today headlines, and it will finish when the tomorrow's papers today's Twitter account drops all their rivals' front pages at sort of 10:30. And they will not, you know, they will have barely 10 minutes to themselves in between that, 5 days a, you know, week, sometimes, you know, sometimes six. And I don't think desks and editors have quite caught up with how absolutely kind of monstrous the job is. And they all say, oh, you know, it's a terribly hard job, and oh, yes, oh, you must take some more time off, and oh, stand back. But you can't, because if you're a political editor, you know, it's a bit like leaving the dinner party, you know, halfway through. You know, you've got to follow the thread of the conversation all the time. And the expectations and the churn is just so massive now. And then if you add into that the kind of, that some people feel that they need to opine and have a point and have a profile and blah, 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 blah. It's not good. It's not good for those people.
It's funny, James. What Francis has just described could not be further away from what we're discussing a few minutes ago, which is somebody who rocks up at 9:30.
No, I left the lobby from day-to-day terms 2014, so I missed out the sort of, you know, emotional intensity of Brexit. But everything Francis has just said, you know, rings utterly true. I mean, yeah, that, yeah, it is an all-consuming and ultimately probably quite harmful job, because you do have to be on all the time and the phone rings all the time. And 7 years since I stopped being a day-to-day lobby reporter, I spent a while as a sort of floating commentator with lobby pass, which was actually quite a relatively nice experience. But I'm very, very glad to, you know, to have stepped off that, or been pushed off that conveyor belt when I was, because, yeah, it's tough. And, yeah, you look back to the days when we started, there was less communication and therefore less pressure. I mean, I would point out, you know, this is the point where I turned viciously on Fraser for the benefit of listeners. At one point, Fraser was my political editor. I was his subordinate and underling. So while you were off enjoying your three-bottle lunches, Fraser, so, you know, I was shackled to desk, churning
out
copies.
That worked for me. That was great.
That was the point when I actually I legally renamed myself on my via deed poll, as my name actually became Fraser Nelson and James Kirkup, because all of my stories mysteriously were, you know, acquired a new name on between my keyboard and going into the newspaper the next day. But it was a simpler, happier time than the one that faces our lobby comrades these days.
Right, so Francis, why should anybody be a political journalist now? What you've just described doesn't sound very attractive.
Because it matters, because it's fun, because where else will you kind of, you know, there's a lovely quote in Tunstall where it says, ask just that question, they say, a lobby hack says, because it's the best show in town. It's best season, the best show in town. I mean, you know, it is a thrill. It's a thrill to know stuff even half an hour before everybody else knows it. And when you're really, really on it, and you really, really kind of, it's all working for you, it is just great to see what's coming, to know where the car's going to come off the road. Oh, right, okay, that's going to be an absolute car crash. I'll just stand here. Oh, there we are, car crashes. You know, and you just know when things are happening. So,
but, and also, if you're willing to give the energy, I imagine, if you're one of these new young people who, for first of all, if you're in your 20s or your early 30s, right, you don't have much of a, you know, a social life, a family life. What you're talking about protecting, Francis. In my journalist career, I've always been walked into newsrooms thinking, hang on, why is nobody here over 40 years old? Where do they all go?
The elephant's graveyard.
Well, no, but that is, it's not really because you all get whacked when you're 40. It's just that the lifestyle that Francis is describing is difficult to balance with a family. And those who try that balance quite often fail. And so it's something which I imagine, if you're willing to give your life to it, it can be huge, fulfilling fun. But if you try to balance that with family or any other interests, that might be where you start to think, well, the balance won't work.
And does that do us any service in terms of the sort of reporting that we get? I mean, you know, aren't we, open question, really?
Now, Francis, you mentioned in your piece how you started off as a regional journalist, you became a national political journalist. What's happening to that relationship now? I mean, your predecessor, Philip Webster, he was a regional reporter, then became a national one. That was a fairly standard path. And then journalism started to change. You got the graduate trainees coming in straight from university. And now sometimes they almost start on the political lobby team. That's like the first job in journalism. Now, when I was at the Times as a business reporter, it was my dream to join the Times' lobby team, to be one of Phil Webster's teams. And I eventually left because they'd eventually promised me I'd join it in 2 years. It never happened. But you would never go straight onto the lobby team. You'd have to cut your teeth somewhere else and then on the lobby. And it seems as if the journey to the lobby is significantly shorter now.
It's shorter, absolutely. I mean, you know, in 1968, only a quarter of lobby journalists were university educated. Now, that was partly because of the war, and even then it was changing very fast and had become professionalised. But and at the same time, the provincial press, regional journalism has died. It survives in extremely attenuated forms, but it's pretty much died. And has it been replaced to some degree by new digital platforms, which, you know, on the whole do better, I think, at recruiting more creatively than Oxbridge?
Well, we've got Harry Cole, the political editor of The Sun. He started on a Guido Fawkes blog. In our day, you would never have thought a blogger would end up going to the lobby, then political editor of The Sun. But Harry is somebody who has come in through that digital training grounds.
Yeah. No. I mean, it is changing, but not enough. And it doesn't, to my view, it doesn't replace the kind of richness of experience that I think there is loss. I think there is a sort of slightly homogenous worldview. And given that the lobby is often accused of groupthink, I think, you know, there is a danger there that people will overthink, look and think and feel the same.
There is a danger of getting into the "it was better in our day" tendency, but one of the characteristics of the lobby in the time we all joined was that you had a group of journalists who had a very clear sense of patch, who knew their local area, their constituencies, the towns and cities and villages that they covered or used to cover when they were reporting for the Press and Journal in Aberdeen or the Wolverhampton Express and Star, whatever it is. And so they knew how life looked from a part of the country and understood that life in Wolverhampton was different to life in Westminster, that the way the country looked from Banff was different. And I do, I think the lack of regional, provincial, in the best way, roots for political journalism is a bit of an issue.
The lobby is much poorer for the absence of people like Des McCartan, right? You know, who famously grumpy, insanely grumpy. Was he Beltel? But he's one of those.
Belfast Telegraph, yes.
And he brought real kind of expertise, you know, and we would gather around and find, you know, this was obviously in the run-up to the Good Friday Agreement. I mean, that guy had massive weight. I mean, you know, his closest equivalent now is Dennis Staunton, who works for the Irish Times, who James sits next to in the lobby, and James Forsyth. And I know values as highly as I do, but they're really rare to find people like that.
James, when you and I worked with the Scotsman, there were, I don't know how many of us, in the Scottish room, in room two. The Scotsman had three political staff. The Glasgow Herald had three plus a secretary.
Seven or eight of us. And David Perry from the Aberdeen Press and Journal, who knew every village in the northeast of Scotland, who knew any story that affected his local patch. Yeah, he would know immediately how...
And now there are probably, I don't know how many Scottish political journalists there are now, but then again, this is just what's happening to our industry. Over the 20-year span that we're talking about, the sales of newspapers will have gone down by about two-thirds, in some cases even some more. So that is inevitable. But one final thing I'd just like to mention, that I remember going to a lobby lunch once where the guest speaker was Robert Kilroy Silk, who was a kind of Nigel Farage precursor. And he made a point which I thought resonated. He was saying that you people will tease me for being, you know, regressive, knuckle-dragging, borderline racist. But have a look around this room. The only people of colour in this room are the ones serving you your lunch. And he was right. The room was chock full of journalists. The only non-white journalists were the waiters. Is that still... I haven't been in the lobby for a while. Is that still a problem, Francis?
I mean, it's got better on gender, but on BAME representation it is absolutely appalling. I think there are two.
Right. So it's funny. So you get journalists criticising the government for not being representative enough, and very few lobby teams of his newspapers would pass the test that we set for the politicians.
Yeah, no, something to ponder the next time there's a sort of moral panic about the reshuffle, you know. Absolutely.
Okay. And looking back, Francis, are you pleased that you did it, given that you've sacrificed as much of your life as you have done?
No, absolutely. It was great. And I mean, I went to the palace yesterday and it was, I wondered how I would feel kind of walking back through there. But I think I'll be fine. I think it's nice just to kind of, it's nice to take in a show for a little bit. And it's also nice to go and do other things.
And James Kirkup, how's your rehabilitation been?
Yeah, I'm recovering. I mean, likewise, I'm really glad I did it. I would never have done anything differently. I did wonderful things. It was fun. It was it was interesting. Some of it may even be important. Political journalism really does do a good thing for the world. It is vital and necessary, and does hold politicians to account. We should never forget that. But I'm really glad that I don't do it anymore, and I would never want to do it again.
On that note, guys, thank you very much for joining me in this podcast.